3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh yeah!
Alternative news, analysis and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your hands.
Good morning, listeners. You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show with me and Rob.
Good morning, everyone. Hope everyone is staying warm.
Nice and cozy.
It's been a bit of a cold change.
Yeah.
The past few days. Past week.
Yeah.
I was out in Calder Park in like Hillside, like out west. It was so windy last week. So windy. It's getting like dust in my eyes. Anyways, hope everyone is staying warm.
I was in Moorabbin yesterday.
Uh-huh.
And watching the footy. AFLW.
Love that.
And it was extremely windy. And it was really funny. Halfway through the game, like the person who was filming the game just did it like quite a long close-up shot of the wind through the trees. Like a directorial, like artistic moment.
Let's take a second break from the game and just look at the trees for a minute.
Yeah, it was
funny. Think a lot of people could benefit from that.
it's funny. How you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. Sleepy. I haven't really been sleeping that well, but you know, I have little birds like outside the front of my house that are always chirping in the morning, so it's kind of hard to wake up in a grump.
Oh yeah,
when you just wake up and the birds are chirping. So
is it a nice chirp?
Yeah, it's lovely. They're all talking to each other or whatever.
That's
they're
cute.
Doing
that's
so it's sort of I wake up really tired and I'm like, well, at least the birds are happy.
Oh, that's so, sweet.
Anyways, how are you?
I'm good. I'm also really sleepy.
Yeah.
I used to have a nemesis with a wattle bird. I love wattle birds, but it would wake me up every morning. I think it was nesting outside my window or something. And every day it would wake me up at like 5 a.m. going, ur-ee, ur-ee. So.
Yeah, that would annoy me too.
Love a wattle bird though.
Interesting. Anyway. Shout out wattle birds.
Shout out wattle birds.
Let's just maybe talk about what we have coming up on the show. So we're going to start off with an interview that you did, Hannah, with Matt Kunkel, who is the CEO of the Migrant Workers Centre. And speaking about the Migrant Workers Centre's current campaigns and how they support migrant workers' rights. And following that, we'll be hearing an excerpt of a conversation from last week's Tuesday Home Time show, in which Jan Bartlett spoke with Amin Abbas about, yeah, it's a really interesting conversation about the genocide happening in Palestine and of course the continued lack of action from leaders all over the globe since October 7th, 2023, and also since 1948. So that'll be happening at around 7:30. And do you want to speak about your interview as well, Hannah?
Yes. We have Isaac from Gecko coming into the studio.
Which is the Goongura Environment Center.
Yes.
For those who don't know.
Yes.
What does the O stand for?
Office.
Office. Love that.
I think it's because, Gecko is more fun.
You remember
than Gek.
It.
Yeah.
And anyway, the show will end with an interview with someone from Whose Future, who have been running a week of actions for Palestine and the climate, which have included some pretty interesting things. So yeah, I'm excited to speak with them at around 8:10 about that.
Great. Should we get into the headlines?
Sure.
Some folks know about it, some don't.
No.
Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty gritty. Let's get right down to the real nitty gritty. Now, one, two, nitty gritty. Now, yeah, boom, nitty gritty.
These are the news headlines for Monday, the 22nd of September, 2025. On Saturday, the historic Coles supermarket on Smith Street in Collingwood was covered in red paint with the words, "Blood on your hands, land back, and justice for Kumanjayi White," painted on the building. This action was a part of Saturday's Justice for Kumanjayi White Solidarity Action. The action intended to redistribute free food and raise awareness to the murder of Kumanjayi White. On the 27th of May, Kumanjayi White was restrained and killed by an off-duty Northern Territory police officer, suspecting him to be stealing food from in a Coles supermarket in Alice Springs. This was the sixth day of actions under the banner of Whose Future, a new broad coalition asking its audience to resist, reimagine, and reorganize. The family of Kumanjayi White have demanded that, one, the police involved in Kumanjayi's death must stand down while investigation is underway. Two, investigation into Kumanjayi's death must be taken over by a body independent of Northern Territory Police Force. Three, release the CCTV footage and body cam footage. Four, police must cease making public statements that allege criminality and degenerate was the character of Kumanjayi White. Coles has refused to release the CCTV footage and the Northern Territory Police are investigating themselves. Lynn Barker, who is a part of Whose Future, said, quote, "Coles, in partnership with the Northern Territory Police, is complicit in the murder of Kumanjayi White. This is another example of how corporations and police work hand-in-hand to uphold settler colonial capitalist interests rooted in racism and prioritizing profit over people," end quote. "We stand here demanding justice for Kumanjayi White," end quote. Mike Davidson also said, quote, "Food should be free and accessible to all. Today we are redistributing food to the community from Coles locked gates. A broad range of actions is necessary and will continue to escalate against Coles and other companies and institutions profiting off stolen land," end quote.
Also in the news this week, the Supreme Court of Victoria has denied all interveners from joining Uncle Robbie Thorpe's case to prosecute King Charles of genocide. The additions of the interveners would have added strength and legitimacy to the case through their ability to add extra information and evidence to the case. Among the interveners were Dr. Auntie Alma Thorpe, Senator Lydia Thorpe, Kieran Stewart Asherton, and Roscoe Lee Brown. They would have inserted evidence into how British invasion and the ongoing genocide on this continent has affected each intervener and their communities. Justices Emerton and Walker of the Victorian Supreme Court said, quote, "We do not consider that any of the interveners' applications would assist the court. To the contrary, we consider that participation of the interveners is likely to unreasonably interfere with the conduct of the proceeding," end quote. Among the submissions would have been Dr. Auntie Alma Thorpe's statement to the Uruk Justice Commission and how the Half-Caste Act was used to commit genocide against First Nations people, Kieran Stewart Asherton would have submitted evidence of smallpox massacres that killed 94% of the UN population, as well as details of the ADF's use of PFAS, which has destroyed the waterways and soil of Wreck Bay and caused birth defects, cancer, and sterility. Desmond Blurton would have submitted evidence of the destruction of the Murujuga rock art, dated over 60,000 years old, and was destroyed by emissions from Woodside's gas plant, as well as evidence of his ancestors being hung and their body parts being displayed around the town as a warning. Also in the news this week, the FBI is said to be considering categorizing trans people as nihilistic, violent extremist threats, according to a report released by independent journalist Ken Klippenstein on September 18th. Two anonymous national security officials said that the Bureau is discussing treating trans subjects as a subset of its new threat category, nihilistic violent extremists, which was created earlier this year. The Bureau defines nihilistic violent extremism as, quote, criminal conduct in furtherance of political, social, or religious goals that derive primarily from a hatred of society at large and a desire to bring about its collapse by sowing indiscriminate chaos. Officials said that such a classification would give the Trump administration political and media cover as they escalate their anti-trans campaign in the aftermath of the death of right-wing pundit Charlie Kirk's death. They are cynically targeting trans people because the shooter's lover was allegedly trans, an unnamed senior intelligence official told Klippenstein, the independent journalist. The administration has convinced itself that the Charlie Kirk murder exposes some dark conspiracy, end quote, they went on. Last week, the false claim that was the word transgender engraved on the bullets that suspect Tyler Robinson allegedly used to shoot Charlie Kirk began circulating widely, and boosted by anti-LGBTQ conservative politicians across the U.S. The governor of Utah, Spencer Cox, later confirmed that there was no indication that the ammunition included any references to the word transgender. On Sunday, the governor told Meet the Press that Robinson was allegedly in a romantic relationship with a roommate who was trans, but provided no additional public information corroborating data or of the roommate's gender. The authorities have stipulated the roommate has been cooperating with the investigation, was not aware of the shooting prior to its occurrence. Despite no evidence linking an alleged trans roommate to Robinson's motivation for allegedly shooting Kirk, right-wingers are nevertheless attempting to use this detail to push an anti-trans agenda. A petition was launched on Thursday by the Heritage Foundation, which is a far-right think tank behind the controversial Project 2025 and its spin-off group, the Oversight Project, asked the FBI to designate transgender ideology-inspired violent extremism as a domestic terrorism threat category. These are the news headlines for Monday, the 22nd of September, 2025.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
The Commons Social Change Library is an online collection of educational resources for those involved in community campaigns and social and labour movements. It collects, curates, and distributes key lessons and resources from progressive movements from around Australia and across the globe. The library includes over 1,400 resources covering campaign strategy, community organising, activist history, digital campaigning, justice, equity, diversity and inclusion, and much, much more. It's free to access the library, so check out the collection at www.commonslibrary.org.
Stay tuned, stay radical.
We demand the full restoration of all Indigenous lands and resources, and we demand the immediate cessation of all forms of exploitation and destruction of our land.
We're here to remind you of our sovereignty and our original demand from day one.
It started with intentional genocide of our people around the round table in England. It's all lies here. Everything's a lie. It's a great opportunity right now. Step into a sovereign, independent republic.
We demand a treaty. We demand our land back. We demand to stop Black Death in custody.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show here at 3CR at 3855 AM. Up first, we're going to be listening back to an interview I did over the weekend with Matt Conkle, the CEO of the Migrant Workers Centre, speaking about their current campaigns and how they support migrant workers' rights. Good morning. How's it going?
Doing well. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Would you like to introduce yourself and tell me a bit about your organisation, the Migrant Workers Centre?
Sure. My name's Matt Conkle. I'm the CEO of the Migrant Workers Centre. We are an organisation that supports migrant workers to understand their rights at work and campaigns with them to defend and extend those rights.
And what are some issues that migrant workers face in the workplace?
So migrant workers face the same issues that all workers face in Australia, but they have some increased concerns around the way that their visas interact with the workplace. And that's the space that the Migrant Workers Centre works with them most closely. Obviously, migrant workers are underpaid like the rest of us are. But in some ways, bad bosses target migrant workers and their relatively lower understanding of our workplace norms and cultures to underpay them in some of the most extreme ways. And also, one of the biggest things that we see at the moment is, and increasingly so, is discrimination, racism and bullying in the workplace, which is a serious concern for us.
Yeah, I saw that you've recently released a report into issues for migrants receiving visa advice. What did you find in that report?
You know, the work that we're doing at the moment is really kind of built out of some changes that we secured to legislation last year that improve protections for migrant workers. Particularly around making a series of new offences for bosses for threatening migrant workers on the to dob them into Home Affairs or get them deported as a way to silence them in the workplace. So we're doing a lot of work around that at the moment, and increasingly we're looking at launching a project around racism as a workplace issue. For a couple of reasons. One, because it's the largest or biggest psychosocial hazard for migrant workers in the workplace. And the second thing is obviously the kind of recent rise in anti-migrant sentiment and kind of racist thugs marching the streets. So that's kind of the two main areas that we're looking at the moment. Look, one thing I would say is now more than ever, we do need to get in and behind, or now more than ever, we need to support migrant workers in our workplaces and include them, because we are seeing that rise of anti-migrant sentiment. We are seeing, you know, dangerous people, Nazis marching the street, and we need to be part of the fight back against that. We need to be supporting anti-racist campaigns. We need to be ensuring that racism in our workplaces is stamped out, because it is an issue at workplaces. It is a workplace issue and a health and safety issue, and there is a lot of important work to be done, and we can only do it if we all unite together.
Yeah. What is the Fair Entitlements Guarantee campaign? How does this impact temporary visa holders?
So the Fair Entitlements Guarantee is a scheme set up whereby the Australian government will pay the unpaid entitlements of workers whose employers go under through bankruptcy or other means. The problem with that Fair Entitlements Guarantee is that it only is payable to Australian citizens and people with permanent residency visas. So what that means is that if you're on a temporary visa, say you're an international student, or you're on a temporary sponsored visa and your employer goes under, all your workmates could get their unpaid leave or wages paid to them, but you would be left with no recourse to recover any of those wages. And we think that is unfair, and it's certainly not a guarantee for the more than 1.7 million workers that are on temporary visas in Australia.
Yeah, and if an employer refuses to pay their worker entitlements, what can they do?
In the instances of a, you know, liquidation or the company phoenixing, there's literally nothing that workers on temporary visas can do to try and recover that money, other than to hope that the employer has some assets left inside the business that it can be recovered by the administrators. But what we see in most frequently, and in almost all cases, is that when a company goes under, there's just nothing there to pay the workers out. And increasingly, or quite frequently, what we see is people will come to the centre and say things like, I haven't been paid for the last 3 months. And that's really the canary in the coal mine for a business that's going under, because they choose to try and put the squeeze on workers before they start to fail to pay their suppliers, etc. So generally speaking, when that happens, it's a really bad sign. But that's why we're running this campaign, to try and have the Fair Entitlements Guarantee extended, so that every worker, no matter where they're from or what visa they're on, can actually recover their entitlements in the instances where their business or where their boss goes bankrupt.
Yeah. Can you tell me more about the importance of the education and advocacy programs that are held by the Migrant Workers Centre?
So the centre runs a wide-scale program about educating migrant workers about what they should expect in the workplace. So not just things like minimum wage and different types of leave and superannuation, but also their rights to a healthy and safe workplace. The most kind of underpinning principle here is that you can't enforce a right that you don't know that you have. Mm-hmm. And the research shows that many folks who didn't grow up in Australia don't understand our workplace system, and also don't our system in Australia is quite different to those in the countries in which they come from. So equipping people with the knowledge about what they should be getting in the workplace is the first step to us organising and working collectively to defend those rights. The other thing we do, importantly, is that as part of this education outreach, we inform workers in across the country and across particularly in Victoria that it's safe, normal and legal to join a trade union, because many are coming from places where it is not safe, it is not legal, and it is certainly not normal to join a trade union. So importantly, we're trying to make sure that all workers, migrant workers included, can be full partners in our democracy and full partners in enjoying the rights that all workers should have. So earlier in the year, there was a consultation being run by the Department of Employment and Workplace Relations, which was seeking for submissions from across the country about the operation of the Fair Entitlement Guarantee. We and a number of unions and community legal centres got together and made submissions to that. And at the time, the response from the government was that they didn't have any intention of changing or making changes to expand to migrant workers. So we are continuing to do some advocacy around that with the politicians. Part of that, there's a petition on our website that you can go to and sign up to that to get more updates about the campaign as it rolls out.
Cool. And sorry, I have another question as well. If someone is getting paid cash in hand under the minimum wage or not getting penalty rates, is there any way that your organisation can help with that?
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the things that we do at the Migrant Workers Centre is, and it's particularly after we've spoken to people at a outreach event or a Know Your Rights workshop, people will come up to us at the end and say, oh, I'm not getting paid correctly, or I'm only getting $15 an hour. We at the Migrant Workers Centre are also a community legal centre, so we do run legal cases and case support for migrant workers who have been underpaid or who have been exploited in some other way in the workplace. And we, wherever possible, look to try and find out if that issue that someone raises with us is a wider issue in the workplace, because at the Migrant Workers Centre, we believe that collective problems have collective solutions.
Migrant workers, like people on student or holiday visas, have the same working rights as anyone else. Do you think that they know this? And do you think that some workplaces are exploiting their not knowing about their workers' rights?
So there is research to show, and there'll be more coming out late this year or early next year, that does show that among some groups of migrant workers, understanding of what they should be paid in Australia is low. And it is almost certain that there are some bosses out there who use this as part of their business model, who predominantly hire only migrant workers, predominantly hire international students in particular, targeting them for exploitation on the basis that they think they can get away with it, and indeed kind of quieten them down by threats of deporting them or disrupting their pathways to settlement, which in the last 12 months has actually become a crime. But again, understanding of these laws is particularly kind of not well known amongst the communities, and that's part of the work that we're doing at the moment to try and raise that awareness.
How can people learn more and support the Migrant Workers Centre?
Well, the best way to get in contact with us is through our website, which is migrantworkers.org.au, or we're located at the Trades Hall in the back building there. So if people want to get in contact with us, they can come down and say hello. But in terms of getting access to our resources, finding out more about the campaigns we're running, or reading the reports and the research that we undertake, you can get all of that at migrantworkers.org.au.
Great. And would you want to remind listeners about the current petition that you have on your website?
Yeah, that petition's just the petition I spoke about a second ago, which is about expanding the Fair Entitlements Guarantee to cover all workers regardless of their visa type. The petition's calling on the government to, in effect, do what the Migrant Worker Task Force said it should do about 7 or 8 years ago now, to expand that to make sure everybody's getting paid. Importantly about this scheme is something that's paid for by the taxpayers, and it's exclusionary and we say discriminatory to not include all those temporary migrant workers in that scheme, who themselves are actually all paying tax. So there's no real good moral reason to exclude them from this scheme that's designed to make sure that all workers are being paid properly and paid what they're entitled to.
And is there any other ways that listeners can help support the cause?
The cause of migrant workers?
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. I think one of the things that people can do out there is to really talk to the migrant workers in their workplace and include them in many different ways, not just socially, but include them in their discussions about joining a union, include them in other kinds of discussions in other ways, and asking questions of them to make sure that they understand their rights. If they don't, you know, or if there are problems with communications, the Migrant Workers Centre has a range of different translated resources, which you can get on our website. But, you know, also increasingly at the moment, it's really important to make sure that migrant workers are not subject to racist abuse or discrimination in or outside of the workplace.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me today.
That's okay. Cheers, mate. See ya.
Thanks. See ya. That was Matt Kunkel, the CEO of the Migrant Workers Centre. To find out more information and how to get some resources, go to migrantworkers.org.au. And to sign their current petition, go to megaphone.org and search No Worker Left Behind, Fair Entitlements for All Workers.
Kefirs are Palestinian scarves, and they're a symbol of support for justice for the Palestinian people. From the traditional black and white kefir to an array of modern designs, explore the range and order online or drop by 3CR during business hours. Wear your support for the rights of Palestinians. Go to kefirs.org.au. That's kefirs.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
Hi, I'm Cam Smith from Yanar Pasaran.
I'm Andy Fleming.
Andy, quick question. The commercial media, that provides a voice to marginalised communities, doesn't it? And as governments around the world take a turn to the far right, it provides a critical anti-fascist analysis?
Cam, how many times do I have to tell you this? No, that's not the case.
Oh, that's not good. So who is doing all that?
Cam, community media, including 3CR, Melbourne's community radio.
And how can we support 3CR in doing that?
We can subscribe, Cam, at any time.
By visiting 3cr.org.au or calling the station on 9419 8377. Subscribe to 3CR.
And stay anti-fascist.
3CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio, streaming at 8:55 a.m. or on the Community Radio Plus app and on the the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au. We'll now be hearing a segment from last Tuesday Home Times show in which Jan Bartlett speaks with Amin Abbas about the genocide happening in Palestine and the lack of action by world leaders against it since October 7th, 2023, particularly as the mainstream media seems to pick up a little bit more coverage of what world leaders are doing to, you know, contemplate pretty superficial actions towards a free Palestine. Amin Abbas is a Palestinian Australian and a co-founder of Olive Kids, an organization dedicated to improving the lives of Palestinian children. You can listen to Tuesday Home Time on Tuesday evenings from 4 till 6 p.m. or listen back at 3cr.org.au/hometime-tuesday. And you can also donate to Olive Kids to help them with their work at olivekids.org.au/donate.
The focus of the program now is Gaza, where the genocidal actions of the Zionist government of Israel continue unabated. I'm speaking with Palestinian activist Amin Abbas and ask you, Amin, do you still have contacts in Gaza at this time?
Yes, we do.
Can you talk about what they're saying to you?
Okay, so obviously the situation in Gaza has been extremely horrific. It's probably been the worst it has been since the beginning of this onslaught. The more recent challenge that we have is that Gaza City, in particular, where a lot of people that were displaced multiple times throughout the war, including from Gaza City, in the most part, a big portion stayed in Gaza City and some returned from their displaced areas to Gaza City. And now the Israeli army seems to be quite intent on reducing it to rubble, similar to what we've done in other places like Rafah, for example. So the situation has been as worse as it has ever been. And more recently, there's been evacuation orders for all of Gaza City. And just to kind of like get maybe the listeners to understand why this is significant, because Gaza City is really the most important part of Gaza. This is where the universities, the hospitals, the orphanage partners that we actually have at Amal are actually in Gaza City. So this is like telling the people of Melbourne or Sydney CBD to evacuate and go elsewhere. And obviously, the comparisons are really different because Gaza itself is so tiny and so small. All of Gaza can probably fit in a subset of those CBDs. So it's really a very challenging situation, particularly when we're talking about a million people that are expected to just, you know, leave everything and get displaced, as all their houses and institutions are actually reduced to rubble. So it's extremely horrific, because also a lot of those people have nowhere to go, because the rest of Gaza also has been not safe at all. So this idea of safe passages do not exist, let alone the fact that what we're talking about here is the idea of really a concentration camp within certain areas in Gaza. And by the way, the term concentration camp could be triggering for some people. But by the way, this is what the Israelis themselves are actually using in their mainstream media. The idea that we are creating concentration camps for Palestinians in Gaza. The reality is we actually are talking about the genocide being so blunt in Gaza City today, and all our partners are really struggling. You're talking about the people themselves that are responsible for children. They're really through their own survival for themselves and their own families. So we're talking about people that are trying to do what they can to help others when in fact they themselves are the victims of these policies of the Israeli government.
Is there evidence that they are already building these concentration camps and where they are?
There definitely are, a lot of those points that the Israeli army are pointing people to go to that are in the most part tents. Some of those are close to the coast in certain areas that are, you know, being directed by the Israeli army. Some of those are also like close to the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation sites. Again, those are death traps in the most part. Like, you know, you're talking about many hundreds of Palestinians that have been shot and killed as they are queuing up to get food. So we are talking about trying to push as many of those Palestinians to certain locations. And, Jana, I'm sure a lot of the listeners do understand that the purpose of Israel in Gaza has not really been about the hostages. If they wanted to get the hostages out, they probably would have negotiated and got something done in maybe October 9th, I think, what was when they were offered the hostages if the war stops. But that's not really the intention. The intention is really get rid of as many Palestinians as possible from Gaza. As it is also the case from the West Bank, they ideally want as much of the geography with at least as least possible from the perspective of the demography. They don't want the Palestinians there. And by the way, this is not new. This is not an October 7th news. This is something that has been the case since the very beginning and the establishment of the State of Israel, that is an ethnostate for the Jewish people only. And sadly, the reality that we have today is the execution of that plan so bluntly in front of the world by genociding the Palestinians and trying to push them out of Gaza as much as possible.
And how are those people, when they are shunted into these concentration camps, going to get food, water, sanitation?
They're not. In reality, obviously, the Israeli government does not care. So what we're talking about, the fact that people are dying, not just from being sniped or bombed, they're actually dying out of hunger, of starvation. And using starvation as a weapon of war has been very well established by a lot of the international organizations that operate in Gaza. So again, this is not news, but the extent and the scale of this happening over the last few weeks, pretty much since the beginning of March, has been escalating. And the fact that this is continuing to be the case by starving the people of Gaza, but at the same time, like pretending that you're giving them aid by doing all these airdrops where people are smashed under them, is really telling us the story. So it's, in answer to your question, there's not really enough food in Gaza. There's no clean water or sanitation. You're talking about thousands and thousands of people squeezed into smaller and smaller areas, declared as safe zones where they are in fact not. We know that all those food distribution sites were declared as, you know, safe places, and we all know that they're not, because people are sniped and killed. We are talking about a catastrophe that has been unfolding in front of our own eyes for the last few months, and a lot more so and a lot more extreme in the last few weeks. And this is what we're hearing from our partners. I mean, our partners are telling us that this time they don't feel that they can survive, that this is really like when they finish with us, they are saying their goodbyes really, really sadly. So I think we're becoming so numb to this. So a lot of us, especially people who are in regular contact with people of Gaza, feel that we live in a parallel world. This is 2025, and we are actually witnessing, again, genocide that is being streamed through our social media, and our governments here are doing nothing to really stop it or to take serious action to really stop it.
Well, when you look at the West Bank, surely the situation there must be getting worse and worse as more and more of the land is taken by the settlers. And what's the food situation there and the supply of water? Because I know that Israel controls most of the water. Do they also control the food that the people are able to get in the West Bank?
The West Bank is not as bad as Gaza from a food security perspective. It is still quite bad, and I also stress that growing up, going to Palestine on a regular basis, to the West Bank in particular, you were talking about agricultural industry was very strong. In fact, West Bank used to export a lot of their produce to neighboring countries, including Jordan, even some of the Gulf states. When I grew up in Jenin, our watermelon used to be considered the best in the world. Today, there's no watermelon grown in the West Bank or in Jenin at all, because Israel has been taking the water from the ground, and up to 80-85% of the in-ground water is actually serving the settlements. The settlements are not just there to steal land and take the hilltops and encircle Palestinians. It's actually there also to take the resources, including water, and also kill industries, including the agricultural industries, because obviously there's no water, there's no agriculture. There's been a lot more strangulation of these industries in the West Bank. And yet there's some, obviously, farmers and some, it's a very expensive, obviously, proposition for a lot of those farmers, but still they are able to survive to an extent. And this is actually, again, like the size of the industry has shrunk significantly over the years. But from a food security perspective, we're still in a better shape in the West Bank compared to Gaza. Water security is a challenge. So this is, again, you know, not really great in the West Bank. Again, nowhere near as bad as the situation in Gaza, which is, you know, obviously facing a total genocide. What the issue is in the West Bank, though, is this ongoing land theft, ongoing settler violence that has been sanctioned by the Israeli government. So settlers can roam free, do whatever they like, kill Palestinians in daylight, and face no consequences whatsoever. No Other Land, one of the contributors to the film that won the Oscar, has been shot dead only a couple of months ago. We're talking on daily basis facing settler violence in the West Bank. The government of Israel is talking about annexing the West Bank now, so bluntly, and, you know, basically saying to Palestinians, you will be encirculated by all these settlements, and this is our Judea and Samaria. Like, this is not something that will ever form a Palestinian state. So we are talking about an ongoing discourse of a very racist government that is bluntly saying that they want to take as much of Palestine, historical Palestine, as possible, get rid of the Palestinians. And again, like, you know, so bluntly saying that we're going to kick a lot of those Palestinians, including from the West Bank, to other Arab states. You are Arabs, you can go somewhere else, which obviously nothing is further from the truth. Palestinians have been deeply rooted in this land, and they will never leave if they were ever left to, obviously, their devices, as opposed to what's happening in Gaza and facing a genocide and really a question of survival.
Well, the vast majority of the Western countries have stood by while all this is happening, and also the bombing of Lebanon, Syria, Iran, Yemen, and now the flotilla ships. But it's getting a bit closer to home now, isn't it, when they've bombed the buildings in Qatar, where a great friend of the United States, a huge American base there, is the tide turning?
I think the tide has been turning, yes. So I guess we don't, it's, you know, not all doom and gloom. And really the work of changing the tide is predominantly done by Israel itself. The fact that it's conducting acts like that, where they're bombing nearly every country in the Middle East without facing any consequences, thinking they can get away with anything they'd like to do, is really telling. So the fact that they bombed Doha, like you said, an ally of the US, you know, the place where, you know, negotiating with interlocutors and really killing them. So really that says a lot about how genuine is Israel being about negotiating a ceasefire and releasing the hostages, let alone, like, you know, obviously being genuine at all with the Palestinians, with, you know, the forever negotiations and in the peace process. So this is really telling about the intentions of the Israeli government. But it is definitely changing the tide. And again, like, they killed, obviously, the prime minister of Yemen. They've attacked the flotilla in Tunisia's international waters. Total impunity. And again, the West seems to be accepting a lot of those acts without really taking serious actions, although some Western countries are starting to take more serious action, like Spain with, you know, the military sanctions, and maybe Ireland with boycotting the settlements. But we need to do a lot more. We need to sanction the Israeli government. We need to kick out the ambassador of Israel. Israel needs to, like, face diplomatic and economic and military sanctions more clearly from the Western government if you truly want to end the genocide and you truly want to ensure that the international rules-based order is actually intact. Because this is really what is at stake, Jan. It truly is that rule-based order and the international legal system that is totally collapsed. So the idea that the West morals of human rights and democracy begs to question, why is there unrelenting support for Israel as it goes more rogue and is committing genocide in broad daylight? What is the West going to do about that? Are we going to move from all that rhetoric and condemnation and with no implications into sanctions, arms, obviously arms sales continue and ambassadors here? You really need to wonder if this is something serious. But is the tide turning? Of course it is, because there's a huge disconnect between the public, those in the streets that you talk to, and those in government that are not taking any action. Those in the streets are growing by the day, and there are, you know, obviously the views of a lot of people on the ground is very clearly anti-Israel and a pro-Palestine. So yes, the tide is turning, but it has taken a lot of bloodshed.
Well, it has to take the United States with it, doesn't it?
Yes, I mean, if you think about the way a lot of those Western countries operate, foreign policy is really ultimately being controlled by the USA. I mean, if there's been more attempts by trying to create a little bit more independent, like-minded, I think is the term that Albanese's government used to really try and come up with like maybe an alternative action on this war. But this is not really good enough. Again, this is very tokenistic. It really stops at words. It does not really include any tangible action. Again, like, you know, the one thing that we can do today is sanctioning this Israeli government. It needs to be done as soon as possible. But you are absolutely right. If the US vetoes any action from a lot of those Western countries and controls how far they can go in taking action, then we're always going to be very limited in how far we can actually go.
Well, finally, I mean, to stop using that word war, because it's not a war.
It is absolutely not a war. It is a genocide, and it is sadly, like, the wording is interesting because we've seen a lot of, like, obviously Western media and mainstream media continue to use words and terminologies in spite of the fact that this is very well established genocide by scholars. They are telling us that this is genocide. For example, every time they refer to Benjamin Netanyahu, they say the Israeli prime minister, as opposed to really saying this is a war criminal that is actually fugitive from the ICC. The ICC have, you know, obviously all Western countries should really, like, that are signatory to the ICC, should take every action to put Netanyahu and his war ministers through the ICC to be investigated for crimes. This is the thing, like the inherent issues here as well, Jan, which is sadly happens quite often, is that the Western news organizations, they cannot cover Palestine because they're not allowed to acknowledge a very central issue here. The racist nature of Zionism and the Israeli state is really, in the most part, is to subjugate the dispossessed Palestinians. And this is not new. This is not an October 7th thing. This is 100 years of dispossessing the Palestinians. And unless we understand what is the core issue here and ensuring that we really think about protecting the human rights of Palestinians, we're not going to go anywhere. And this is becoming, especially with this collapse of the world rules-based order, Palestine becomes a litmus test. It's really the issue that frees all of us, not just Palestinians, because if we're unable to really tackle Palestine and we face consequences, if we really want to use the right terminology, then it really begs the question, are we really living in free societies that really advocate for human rights and democracies and freedom for all? This really begs that question, because they probably come for Palestinians today, but they will come for everybody else tomorrow. So really, freeing Palestine frees all of us. And this is really something very important for all your listeners to keep in mind as we really think deeply about what's happening right now and the complicity of the West and our governments in what's happening today in Palestine.
Thank you, Amin.
Thank you very much, Jan. I appreciate the time.
Tahi, Rua, Tore, Fa.
Hoppe, Kiraro. Hoppe.
Hey,
It's really good. It's really good. Can we...
Has Centrelink made a decision you disagree with? Most Centrelink decisions can be appealed up to 3 times. Examples of decisions you can appeal include whether you're eligible for a payment, cancellation or suspension of your payment, how much you get paid, and Centrelink debts. One of the most common Centrelink decisions appealed are Centrelink debts. Centrelink will say you owe a debt if the staff determine you've been paid more than you should have. Debts can occur for a variety of reasons. In some instances, if there's been an administrative error or if you have special circumstances, you may not have to repay that debt. The appeal process is free, but time limits can apply and will affect your entitlement to back payment. Social Security Rights Victoria is a specialist community legal centre providing Victorians free advice to help you understand your Centrelink issues and the appeal processes. You can contact Social Security Rights Victoria on 9481 0355 or online at ssrv.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show here at 3CR at 8:55 a.m. We're now joined in the studio with Isaac Carne from Gecko, or the Goongroo Environment Centre. Good morning.
Good morning, Hannah. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very good. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Do you want to start by telling me about the Erinandra Forest for people who haven't been, and how you first got involved with the Goongroo Environment Centre?
Sure. So the Erinandra Forest, or the Erinandra Plateau, is in East Gippsland. So that's Eastern Victoria. Mm-hmm. And it's a very special place because it's, amongst other things, it holds the largest tract of cool temperate rainforest in mainland Australia. And it's home to a host of threatened species like greater gliders. It actually has like almost a third of threatened species in Victoria. That's more East Gippsland. But Erinandra Plateau also, it's climate refuge for cool temperate adapted species. Mm. So it's a very important refuge and a place that we should definitely... try to protect just for these future threats as well. I guess, like, for me, it was in 2017 that I met some people at Gecko on a forest blockade near Erinandra in Quark. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't until 2020 that I ended up living in Goongroo, which is in the heart of the forest. And I ended up there because of COVID, because it was like my COVID refuge. And through living there, I kind of quickly discovered like how nonsensical was logging, because just a few months later, and remember that also that was like the bushfires just hit Goongroo really hard and the whole of East Gippsland. And then COVID happened, so it seems like everybody just kind of forgot about those fires. But for a lot of the people there, that was, you know, a very traumatic experience. And for people that had fought really hard to protect those forests, then seeing that those fires ravaged through it in just one night, it was a really hard thing to go through. And just a few months later, the machines just started on and just went as business as usual. And I guess for me, that was what really activated me in trying to stop the logging, really.
Yeah. I mean, Goongroo would be a pretty great place to spend COVID in.
It was. It was.
Yes, it was a bleak time.
Mm. Well, you have more memories of before the fires than I do, because you grew up in there.
I did. I did grow up there. Yes. I was living with my mum during the fires, and she was on the phone constantly with people who were in Goongroo, and just, yeah, it was a really sad time. And going back to Goongroo after the fires And I mean, when I was a kid, I was convinced that I had memorized every tree along the Bonang Road, which is a very dense, was a very dense, beautiful rainforest. And then just seeing like the ground afterwards, because it was, you never used to be able to see the ground. You couldn't really see very far because it was covered in beautiful vines and tree ferns and old growth trees and stuff. So that was really sad. But I'm holding on to like the fact that Erinundra, not all of it, like a lot of it's still there. So
yes, that's right. Yeah. Erinundra didn't burn because it's a wet forest. So it actually, it acts as a fire break.
Speaking of fire breaks, do you want to tell me the impacts of Forest Fire Management Victoria and how they're impacting endangered animal habitats and just forests in general?
Yes. Well, I guess first, I think that for a lot of people and also us, the end of logging in 2024 was like, you know, an incredible moment that kind of decades of forest activism had been waiting for. And in a way, like, I think a lot of people were like, oh, that's great. Forests are safe. We, you know, we did, we achieved our goal and it's all hunky-dory now. But I guess, like, because that bigger threat had been the main focus of the campaign, we hadn't really looked too closely at the impacts of Forest Fire Management Victoria had in the forest. And I guess when logging ended, that's what started to raise to the surface, is like how destructive as well those practices can be. I think like there's a lot of outdated science on forest fire management. Yeah. And I think that part of the issue is that the scientists that are coming up with, like, you know, more granular and more place specific fire management are not being heard.
Yes.
But also, like, there's I think a lack of accountability with operations that they take. I guess how I see it and how we see it is that it's a little bit like ground zero. So logging also had no accountability, and it was through citizen science and forest campaigning that we started putting checks and balances into their operations, including in courts. But forest fire management haven't had that to date. So they pretty much just kind of go out and do whatever they want. So there's things like roadside tree clearing that they do. They just don't really do many surveys for threatened species or, you know, hollow-bearing trees. They just, a lot of them, they get chopped down because they're considered dangerous trees. And it'll be about 4 months ago also, we discovered that in the Erinundra Plateau, some frog sites, breeding sites for Littoria watsonia, that's an endangered frog species, had been actually sprayed with herbicides. And then not only that, but then after they were doing like some grading on the road, and like a bulldozer just went over those frog sites. And those frog sites were mapped. The department had those locations of those frog sites. And in previous years, they had put measures around and then they just protect those sites.
Yeah.
But this year, they hadn't done, they hadn't put those measures, so they actually just went over it. So you kind of see how the department that is supposed to actually protect those species, they're the ones actually that can be causing that damage. So we reported the damage to the OCR, which is the Office of the Conservation Regulator. And surprisingly, they told us that they couldn't investigate their own department.
Yes.
So well, we reported to the federal government, the Environment Department of the federal government, and then we also reported directly to DECA and the minister. That's been over 4 months now. And I think, like, we've heard from DECA, then they passed it on to the minister, and then recently we heard from the minister's office that they've passed it on to DECA again to respond to us. But to date, we still haven't got any responses, like what really happened there and what measures are they going to put in place so it doesn't happen again.
Yeah, we had Rena on the show a few months ago speaking about this frog and the damages to their breeding sites. And it's sad to know that not really much has happened since we were speaking to Rena. Do you want to tell me about the new details in the process of making Arunundra a national park and how that will protect stuff like this from happening?
Yeah, well, there's already a national park in Arunundra, but when it was created in a way that it kind of like divvied up the park, like some for protection and some for logging. So it has holes in the middle of the park, and it doesn't have like really a rationale to protect actually all the high conservation value forests in it. So I think like since logging ended, like one of our main asks has been to complete the park and to actually include all those forests within the park, because and people would say perhaps that now that logging has ended, like why do we need parks? But I think that the parks is and other reserves is the best way we have to protect those places from future threats, like policy reversals. So let's say the coalition gets in Victoria, and they've already been talking about reintroducing or starting logging again. They call it different names, but that's the one of the main threats. Of course, like that has to come as well with investment in Parks Victoria and investment in in restoration in threatened species. And that's been another of the the sad trends in Victoria, that over the last 10 years there's been like an ongoing gutting of the funding of Parks Victoria that has reduced their capacity to actually do their job. Of course, then some people get upset because they see that some of the infrastructure is not well maintained. There's not enough park rangers in Arunundra and Coopera Cranbourne, which are like tens of thousands of hectares of national park. There was one park ranger. Now they're advertising for another park ranger. Yeah. So what sort of like work can you do with such little resources? On the other hand, we've seen how the government has spent $1.3 billion into the forestry transition program. So that means to transition businesses that were relying on native forest logging into other sort of sources, which also that's been a process that it has not been very transparent. We know that a lot of that money has gone into private businesses, and some have transitioned to other type of let's say sources, but also we know that some of the bigger ones, like they're still importing logs from native forests from Tasmania and New South Wales. So you know, we're again like in a process where in 2019, when the government announced the end of native forest logging, they said it was going to be also, you know, the largest expansion in the reserve system in Victoria's history. That was like the words at the time. We've seen a lot of money going into private businesses, and we haven't seen any of those areas actually being included into any parks or reserves. In fact, recently, you know, the Allan government, with also the Environment Minister Dimopoulos, they've said that they're not going to create any new national parks. That's why we're asking for extensions of existing national parks, right? Yeah. But the trend has been quite worrying. And in fact, for the last couple of years, the Environment Minister, Steve Dimopoulos, which is also like the tourism minister, he's also the sports minister. So he really had very little clue about the environment. He has been not talking to any environmental groups up until very recently.
Yeah. Classic.
Classic. But we're still there. And I feel like, I guess, in the last little while, he seems like he's starting to listen. Who knows if it's because there's an election next year and he's starting to fish for some election promises. But there's an opening now. And we feel quite positive that we could get some good outcomes for East Gippsland. And perhaps the Arenandra Plateau is a good thing to ask the minister, because I think it's definitely like a no brainer, and it's something that he should get behind. Yeah. I think the main challenge is to make him understand how special this forest are. Yeah. And that's what we started to do from Gecko, just asking our supporters as well to write to the minister to send him photos of Arenandra. There's a lot of people that that support Gecko that have been either to Gecko camps or they've been exploring the Arenandra Plateau. And if you've been there, you know how special this forest are.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you want to, we only have time for maybe one more question, but can you tell me about Gecko's partnership with First Nations and the local community through Emerald Link and what that means? And also about Marjorie Thorpe's work in restoring forests, the Bitterwool map, and that connection to the Arenandra Forest?
Sure. So Emerald Link has been a project of Gecko in partnership with Wilderness Society for quite some time. And at the time, it was to change the narrative as like logging the only way of having an industry in East Gippsland, to looking at other ways that we can actually interact and take care of nature without having to destroy it. So nature-based tourism infrastructure, also restoration projects. And the way that Emerald Link has operated is partnering with local communities to see what the kind of aspirations for their places, for their country are, and try to work together to bring investment to see those projects happen. Mm-hmm. In the last year, we've formalized the partnership with Marjorie Thorpe, Gana Kanai elder, and also, you know, living in Lake Tyers Trust. And Marjorie is really keen to see cultural and environmental center just around the Nawanawa school happen. That's like kind of really early days. But I think the main goal is to actually bring together First Nations groups and environmentalists and the broader community together to discuss how we can take care of country better. Mm-hmm. So it's talking about forest management from a place of actually getting people together, because I think that, you know, a lot of the times we're all kind of talking in our own little silos, but when we come together and discuss things as a group and as a community, I think we have we realize that we have more things in common than we thought. And with Bitterwell are the traditional owners of the Arenandra area and east of the Snowy River. And Gecko has had a long-standing relationship with Bitterwell for decades. So we've been talking with Bitterwell as well to see how we can support each other. And they've actually also expressed that they would like to see the Erinandra National Park being completed. So all these high-value conservation forests also being included in the national park. So what we're doing is we're putting together a bit of a document with some nice photos of Erinandra that we want to put in front of the minister with all those different voices as well, to ask him to actually just to complete the national park and also invest in the region. I think there's, you know, there's some infrastructure projects in Erinandra that we would like to see happening, extension of some walks, and also some infrastructure that need repair after decades of not having any investment in those areas. And I think for a lot of people, that's what they like to see, that they can go to places that there's a walk to do, or there's a camp spot with basic drop toilets. You know, we're not asking for too much, but I think that we need that backing as well to see those places properly protected.
Yeah. And lastly, do you want to remind listeners on how they can support Gecko and how to get in contact with the minister?
Sure. I think that we've been asking our supporters to write to the environment minister, Steve Dimopoulos. I think he's a little bit, he believes himself to be a bit of an Instagram influencer. So he likes to be on socials quite a bit. Mm. So I think the best way to actually contact him is through Instagram. And we are asking people to follow him on Instagram, Steve Dimopoulos, that's his name. And just comment on his posts and remind him about Erinandra. Remind him that he actually needs to deliver on his government promise to protect forests. Also through email, we've been asking supporters to send him photos of Erinandra to kind of paint a picture of how special those forests are. There's a post on our website at gecko.org.au about the asks to the minister and the government, and also how to reach. And I guess, like, for us, you know, we're a tiny organization, the only paid campaigner, just very part-time. So as well, like, any donation really helps. Like, and if you can donate $10 a month, that goes a long way, really. And I mean, I know that there's so many causes that deserve our attention. I guess, like, also for, you know, if you know this forest, if you you've been to East Gippsland, and if you don't, like, please just come and visit. But for whoever can, like, any help goes a long way.
Great. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thank you so much for coming in this morning.
Thanks so much, Hannah.
Thank you.
3CR, your station, your voice.
Do a bit of disrupting and cause a bit of ruckus in the colony.
Always was, always will be.
Not celebrate Australia, but instead pay homage to the resistance of First Nations people against this illegal colonial occupation.
3CR, your station, your voice.
This country's black future is a fire.
When I was new to Melbourne, I found a Food Not Bombs flyer on the road, and I had, like, this fist with a carrot, and carrots are my favourite vegetable. Yeah, I think they were asking for help doing stuff, and I got in touch.
We, I guess, rescue food
that would otherwise go to waste.
I like the aspect of sharing food and not making anyone feel obligated to pay anything for it.
We make a real point at Food Not Bombs of involving everyone who wants to be involved in whichever part they want to be involved in.
For more information, go to fnbmelb.noblogs.org. Food Not Bombs is a 3CR supporter. Food Not Bombs.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio. We're now joined by Gemma of the newly formed group Whose Future, which is a broad coalition of grassroots activists who launched a week of action from Tuesday the 16th of September to disrupt profit-driven systems of oppression. Good morning, Gemma.
Good morning, Rob.
Thank you so much for joining us. Maybe you would like to start by telling us about Whose Future and how the group was formed?
Yes, totally. Whose Future was kind of an idea of how do we respond to the multitude of crises in a truly intersectional way and combine tactics of not only disruption and resistance, but incorporate ideas of regeneration by like reimagining how can we actually do things, how can we make change now and not wait for governments or institutions to change at the slow rate that they do change, and actually just begin to reorganize our communities as well. So I guess it was an idea and an experiment, and it's been really beautiful to see the broad variety of different actions across the spectrum of hardcore staunch direct action and then community-based restorative caring actions as well, such as community dinners and zine fairs and things like that.
And obviously y'all have been a part of a week of action which began last Tuesday, I believe. What has been part of this action?
It started on Monday, actually, with an action down at the web dock with two people on two different tripods and someone locked into a car to try and disrupt the flow of trade, especially to Israel, but more broadly disrupt trade and disrupt business as usual to try and halt the flow of this like infinite extraction and growth that is really the root cause of a lot of the problems that we have. It kind of just went from there. We had people blocking a freight train into the port on Wednesday. We had people who found the home address of a fossil fuel CEO, the CEO of Viva Energy, who are trying to build a gas terminal out of Geelong, really close to homes, which poses a pretty severe explosion risk and other health problems. Down there, so they found the home of that CEO and occupied his roof for a little while. We also had like the community focused events, including a community dinner at a local community guerrilla garden down at Bracken Creek. People did a solidarity action outside a Coles in the city to stand in solidarity with Kumon J. White, the young Wall-free man who was murdered by police in an Alice Springs Coles earlier this year, and also stand up against the corporate greed and the wage theft and the price gouging of corporations like Coles. So it was a really broad mix, which is really, really awesome to see.
I did want to ask about the action on web doc. I do know that, you know, previous times when things have gone on there to disrupt trade, there police have been pretty tough in their response. How was it last week?
I wasn't there, but from what I heard, I think it was just the same as usual. The police come in hard with lots of personnel, but I think it was fairly calm. There wasn't any real massive escalations beyond what was expected with the people who were blocked on or suspended from tripods just being removed. But, they were there for 3 hours, and the Container Transport Alliance group actually put out an article detailing the level of disruption caused by that, and they said that at least 300 trucks would have been stopped. Which is, it's good to know that it's about 100 trucks an hour that usually get pumped through the dock. From a disruption point of view, I think people are pretty happy with that.
Yeah, so obviously it's probably been a busy week for you and other people in Hugh's Future. I can imagine you'd be all very tired, but yeah, maybe you'd like to talk about what's next for the group.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's at this point, it's more of a public call out of, you know, we've got this idea. We think that the way the system is currently operating only serves the wealthy few and comes at the expense of everyone else across the issues of genocide in Palestine, climate and ecological breakdown, and the continuation of colonial violence. Those are like the three, I guess, focuses of the idea at this point. And so, yeah, I think the call out remains for people to take autonomous actions and, yeah, think about combining the idea of reorganizing things and reimagining things as well as resisting. We need all three to move forward into the world that we want. So, yeah, I mean, the Instagram page will stay live, and as has been the process this week, people who want to do an action in line with this idea can do that and send that into the Who's Future Instagram. But for people who want to get involved, I would say, yes, just keep an eye on the social media and on the website, and yeah, we'll see what comes next.
Maybe you just like to, yeah, what is the Instagram tag?
The Instagram is just at Who's Future, so WHOSE and then future with no question mark or no numbers or anything, just Who's Future.
Okay, awesome. Well, that's pretty much we all have time for, Gemma. Is there anything else you wanted to quickly add?
Yeah, I would just say that we really want people to feel empowered, whether they're part of a group or part of a long planned action or actions, that really we can just get out there and do stuff. It's really, really good for the soul to go out and resist and reimagine and reorganize in the face of the very overwhelming poly crisis that we're living through. So, yeah. Get out there.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us, Gemma, and yeah, good luck.
Thank you so much.
That was Gemma from the recently formed group Who's Future, which aims are to resist systems built on violence, dispossession and exploitation of land and people, reimagine what futures are possible and what society could look like, and also to reorganize in ways that enable communities and ecosystems to flourish. And as they said, you can reach out to them and stay up to date with what they're doing on Instagram. Their tag is at Who's Future. You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Shows. We'll be back in a second.
Public transport's great.
What's not great is that unless you've got a radio with you, you can't listen to 3CR when you're on it.
Until now. The Community Radio Plus app lets you listen to us wherever you are.
Get on board and search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
Time's on my mind when I had to find my side. Am I thinking loud? Do I want you around?
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show. It's just before 8:30, so we will just wrap up the show. We began the show with an interview with Matt Kunkel, the CEO of Migrant Workers Centres, about migrant workers' rights. We then heard a conversation with Jan Bartlett from Tuesday Home Time with Amin Abbas about the genocide in Palestine. Then we also heard Hannah speaking with Isaac Carne from the Goongra Environment Centre. And the show ended with a conversation between myself and Gemma from Who's Future. You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show. Stay tuned for Women on the Line, and we'll see you next week.
Bye. 3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find NIBS opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall, Carlton. Keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.